Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm singer-songwriter Erin McKeown, in for John Schaefer, who's out on vacation this week. We've got a big show ahead. Husband and wife duo The Handsome Family is here to play some songs from their new album, Wilderness. And I'm happy to say that one of my musical blind spots will be no more after I learn all about the band Black Sabbath from a writer who calls himself a Sabbathologist. This is my second day of guest hosting Soundcheck, and I have to say I've gotten very comfortable here. Have me back. I've already got my routine. Come into the office, meet the staff, prep for guests, host interviews. It's all very structured. Pretty different from my normal day as a musician, where my schedule is totally up to me. The daily routines and habits of artists are at the heart of a new book called Daily Rituals, How Artists Work. Mason Curry is the author of that new book, and he joins me here in the studio. Hello, Mason.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Your book covers the daily habits of all sorts of famous artists, from choreographers to writers to musicians. Did you notice any consistent differences or similarities by field? I mean, do writers drink more? Do musicians pray more?
I think I did notice some similarities between writers and composers having a harder time disciplining themselves to the desk for long periods. A lot of their routines seem to be about figuring out ways to kind of avoid procrastination and blocks and kind of get that time in every day. A lot of the visual artists, by contrast, seem to have the opposite problem. They needed a routine to keep themselves from spending all day in the studio and to kind of get away from the work and, see their girlfriends or boyfriends and have a normal life.
I mean, I think that's the thing that defines in some ways the artist as opposed to the office worker. You're in charge of your own day in a certain way. And that's totally different than a 9-to-5 schedule. Or in some ways, is it not so much different? I mean, were you surprised at how rigid some of these routines were?
Yeah, there are a lot of people who really did treat their creative activity like a 9-to-5 day job. And, they needed that structure in order to kind of to get to work every day. Otherwise, they would kind of never get down to it. And then there are other people who were just kind of obsessed with their work. One of the composers in the book is George Gershwin, and he, his brother Ira, said that he always seemed kind of just obsessed and that you kind of couldn't get him away from the piano. He would sit down in the morning in his bathrobe and slippers and basically just keep at it for 12 hours a day. And even if he had to go out in the evening, he would sit back down at the piano when he came home after midnight.
I'm Erin McKeown, in for John Schaefer. I'm talking with Mason Curry, the author of the new book, Daily Rituals, How Artists Work. Listeners, do you have a set daily routine for your creative work? Call us and leave a voicemail about it, 866-939-1612. Mason, why do you think habit, as opposed to maybe even rigidity or structure, but why is habit so important for creativity?
I think that, a lot of artists have talked about how it kind of trains your brain to get into this creative mindset on a daily basis. You know, there's something about knowing that you're going to do this every day at a certain time that lets you get into a kind of daily creative rhythm, I think, for a lot of people. A lot of people find that if they wait for inspiration to strike, it may never strike, and that having a routine is a way to kind of guarantee some sort of creative activity or kind of make sure you get into this mindset on a regular basis.
Let's actually talk to a caller. I'm so excited. This is my friend Natalia Zuckerman on the line. Natalia, you there?
Yeah, hi.
Natalia is a singer and songwriter and painter based in Brooklyn and also a close friend of mine, full disclosure. I want to ask you this first. Do you have a set routine that you follow for creativity, for creating, and then follow that up? How do you divide it between music and painting? You have thriving careers in both.
I don't really have a set routine that much because my life is so much on the road. I think one thing that I definitely do every day is physically exercise because otherwise, everything is just kind of head space and cloud space, so I have to really try to ground it that way.
Now, you grew up in a household where both your parents were artists. Your father is the violinist Pincus Zukerman, and your mother is the writer and flautist Eugenia Zukerman. I'm curious, like, growing up as a small fry in that house, like, did you notice mm-hmm. that they had routines as artists? And then as you became an artist later in life, was there something that you could point to that you learned or picked up from, or even specifically that they told you, daughter, here's how to be an artist?
Yeah, I think definitely forcing classical music on me as a child, practicing. I played violin as a kid and pretty much hated it from day three. But the discipline of practicing every day was definitely passed down to me. And if a day goes by where I haven't been disciplined, they're in my little army of people sitting by saying, you should really apply your ass to the chair, as my grandfather used to say.
Right. Before we let you go, let me just ask you, what's the routine today?
Today is a little different because I'm leaving for 3 weeks. So this morning was everything fabulous, from making sure all my bills were paid to returning something to a store and cleaning out my car. It was not the creative morning I would generally have.
Good luck, my friend. I'll see you later.
Thank you, Karen.
That's Natalia Zukerman, painter and singer-songwriter based in Brooklyn. Mason, Natalia was talking about today, she, you know, paid some bills and had to take care of stuff around the house and cleaned out her car. Like, what's the role of the mundane in the artist? You know, Steve Reich, for example, talks about he spends his mornings doing business.
Yeah, that's right. He did. And, you know, I think that the mundane can be useful in some ways. Another interesting story was about Tchaikovsky had a sort of compulsion that he had to clear his desk or his ledger of any kind of mundane chores or business work before he could sit down to compose. And I think that seems to be true of a lot of people. You need to kind of create some kind of mental space or carve out some kind of time where you can concentrate on that one task. And often that means taking care of all that other stuff first.
Guest here is Mason Curry, the author of the new book, Daily Rituals, How Artists Work. I'm Erin McKeown, in for John Schaefer on Soundcheck. Mason, a lot of artists in the book talk about coffee, sugar, drugs, alcohol as aids to their creativity. Can you make their, as you know, I'm someone who abstains from everything on that list, actually.
Okay.
And I'm curious if there's an argument that can be made for or against creativity as being aided significantly by these things. My personal experience is, obviously, I prefer it without. But there's plenty of stories of people who need it.
Yeah. I mean, I think if you were going to make a case for anything, it would be for coffee, because that comes up over and over and over in the book. Beethoven believed that the perfect cup of coffee had 60 coffee beans, and he would count them out one by one for the precise dose in the morning before getting started at his work. And there were just like story after story of all these coffee making and coffee drinking rituals. Although I think some of it is actually the ritual of making the coffee as much as the actual caffeine that sort of gets you into this mood or state of mind.
Right, and if you're going to have some kind of ritual in the morning, like mm-hmm. that's probably the least harmful,
I guess.
You know, Gertrude Stein had an interesting quote in your book where it said she was nervous about being nervous,
yeah.
and the coffee didn't help that.
Yeah,
which I can totally relate to. That's the reason I don't do coffee. But what about drinking? Where does drinking fit in with all of this? Because there's a romantic notion of like the artist is this like, you know, laying on the floor passed out and then rolls over and writes something genius.
Yeah, I think that's mostly a myth. You know, most of the people in that I ran across, even the ones who are famously famous drinkers, did drink a great deal often, but they also usually carved out some part of the day for sober composition. There were very few stories that I found of people actually regularly working while drinking alcohol. They would work and maybe then immediately start drinking alcohol afterwards, but the few times I found people who would drink, it would be they would end up saying later that it had, you know, harmed their work.
What about drugs? Louis Armstrong, big weed smoker.
Yeah, he was a lifelong pot smoker. And also he was hooked on all these strange like herbal remedies. He had this special salve that he would apply to his lips before a show. And he was hooked on this this herbal laxative called Swiss Chris, which I think is still on the market today. And he would take it religiously, I think, before and after shows, and even recommended it to all his friends, and had this, like, really bizarre postcard printed up to give to friends to, you know, say he should check this out, of himself sitting on the toilet with this slogan that said, leave it all behind ya.
My days have grown so lonely, I've lost the one and only. My pride has been humbled, for I'm her body and soul. Oh, babe, I was a mere sensation.
That was Louis Armstrong, Body and Soul. Louis Armstrong, famous for his bathroom habits. Let's take a call right now. This is musician and composer Peter Buffett. Hello, Peter.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very well. We asked online for people to write in about their routines, and your routine was quite succinct. It was coffee.
Yes, all caps, I think.
Does that mean you'd had a lot of coffee?
It means that's the first thing that happens. The morning is definitely coffee-fueled, actually espresso-fueled.
And then is coffee part of the rest of your day of work? Like, how much do you, are you someone who spends the morning working and then the afternoon in some other endeavor, or does it spread out through the day?
It's usually, I think, what more of us do now every day, which is respond to other people's emails. So, in other words, people are sending you all these things they hope you'll respond to, and that's what your morning, my morning, is certainly taken up with, probably until at least noon or one or beyond, depending. And then do what I need to do, either for the musical work, foundation work, that sort of thing, in the afternoon. And then finally, in the evening, is usually when the true musical time happens.
Peter, you mentioned the way that our morning is taken up these days now with responding to electronic communication from folks.
Right.
Do you find that distracting to the rest of the day? Would you rather that at a different time of day? Do you feel pressure to do that at the early part of the day as opposed to the later part of the day?
Sort of. I mean, I feel like in one sense I want to get it out of the way so I can clear my brain for other things, but it will lead to distractions because, you know, one thing leads to another thought and then another one. And then so there are times when I purposely say, you know what, I'm not going to do it this morning. I'm going to focus on what I need to and then deal with it later. I think it's an ongoing adjustment we're all making to incoming email all night.
Which in some ways probably like, you know, there's probably some equivalent for Mozart. Mason, is that true?
Actually, Mozart's routine, there's a great letter he sent to his sister in the late 1700s describing his routine as kind of like a freelancer in Vienna. And he talks about how, you know, he spends his whole day rushing around to kind of entertain wealthy patrons and perform concerts and give piano lessons, and he can't finally get to his composing work until late at night, you know, maybe as late as midnight. So that actually sounds very similar to what a lot of people today deal with. It's amazing how contemporary his routine seems.
Peter, you have a very famous father, Warren Buffett. Has your father passed on any routines or creativity or advice to you around how to have a productive day?
Well, you know, he is so famously able to focus on what's important to him and not let other stuff, outside influences, bother him, you know, whether it's trends in tech or anything else. He sort of ignores the outside world, and he has shown me the value in that, you know, where you need to focus on yourself first and what you need to get through the day as opposed to get pulled off center by outside influences. And so, I have learned that from him, although I haven't perfected it yet.
This is musician and composer Peter Buffett. Thank you so much for calling in today, Peter.
Absolutely. Thank you.
All right, we're going to take another call. This is another friend of mine, singer-songwriter Matt the Electrician. Matt, are you there?
Hello.
Hi, Matt. Obviously, from your name, we can make the assumption that you've made a transition from someone who had a pretty set routine in one vocation to another, a less structured day perhaps as an artist. Is that true? Is that not true? What are the similarities in your day between being a master electrician and now a master songwriter?
Well, just to be clear, I was a journeyman electrician and not a master.
Small detail, I'm sorry.
I don't want to misrepresent myself at all. I know there's probably a lot of electricians listening. Yeah, it's definitely a less structured day now. Doing construction is just kind of nonstop, and I would usually get to the shop at about 6:30 in the morning and get back to the shop at the end of the day at about 7 or 8 o'clock at night. And you're pretty much just working that whole time. You get like half an hour, 45 minutes for lunch. But
You do have a really interesting routine now for creativity. If I'm right, you try to write a song a week. And how does that break up day by day?
Well, I write every day, but I have a song due once a week. And so ideally I'm working on that song every day, but sometimes I just, I'll just write every day and maybe the song doesn't get worked on. But the song's due every Wednesday before midnight. And so if I haven't been working on that song throughout the week, then if it's 11:45 on Wednesday and I haven't written something, I have to write and record an entire song. And I get it done every week. I haven't missed a week, on this go-around, which has been at least 6 months.
And some of those songs have made their way to your records and are quite fabulous, I must say. So whatever it is about the deadline and the routine, it turns into really great music. This is Matt, the Electrician, a singer-songwriter based in Austin, Texas. Thanks for calling in, Matt.
Absolutely. Thank you, Erin.
So, Mason, Matt was talking about these long days as a journeyman electrician. Are there other artists who translate that to their art? Are there artists who take 9 to 5 at a desk and consider their art like a job?
Yeah, a lot of people in the book actually work that way. That they treat, you think of artists as being these kind of reckless, dissolute people who wait for inspiration to strike. But so many people in the book really did treat it like a 9 to 5 day job. One person who springs to mind is John Updike. He compared his writing to a dentist drilling his teeth every morning. He kept an office, like on Main Street in a small town, and would go there every day and sit down at his desk and work for a set period of time, 3 or 4 or 5 hours, and then have lunch, and then he would kind of deal with his chores. And then that was it. It was very much a 9 to 5 job for him.
Yeah, there's another story in your book of Maya Angelou. She kept a hotel room.
Yeah.
As she said, the meanest, meaning average, the most average, the better, with like a bed, the Bible, and if she could have a washtub. But that was it. And she would go there and work.
Yeah, yeah. She said that she needed home to be very, a nice, she liked to have a nice home, and that she couldn't work in a nice home, that it threw her off. So she liked to keep these kind of anonymous hotel or motel rooms to go work in. And then she would do that for half the day, and then she would go back home and like take a shower and clear her mind and make dinner, and her husband would come home and she could have kind of a normal evening. But the creative work kind of happened in this like secret little hole in the wall place where she could go and be weird and be by herself.
I really actually love that story. Just imagine her going to a different motel, or I've been in some pretty interesting motel rooms myself and have found them to be actually good places, right, for that reason. They're sort of distinct from your everyday life. You, Mason, are a writer who wrote a book about writers and creative people. I'm curious what your routine is like.
I've always been a morning person. I find that if early in the morning, around sunrise, I have like a certain kind of brain power that I just don't have later in the day. I feel like part of it is almost being kind of tired and half awake. I feel like it's harder to procrastinate and be distracted, and it's easier to kind of focus on the writing. So working on this book, I was also working a full-time job as a magazine editor. So my routine was to get up at 5:30 every morning and work on the book for 2 hours, and then have breakfast with my wife and take a shower and ride the subway to work and have a normal 8 or 9 hour work day, and then hit the library a lot of evenings. And then the weekends were a little bit more flexible. But for me, it's really about those like 2 good hours first thing in the morning. Sometimes I get more done in that time than I do the entire rest of the day.
My guest today has been Mason Curry, the author of the new book, Daily Rituals, How Artists Work. Thank you so much, Mason.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Every day.
Up next, heavy metal band Black Sabbath had the #1 album in the country last week with their new release called 13, and I have a Sabbath secret that I will reveal in just a moment. I'm Erin McKeown, singer, songwriter, and the world's only soundcheck sports blogger. Back in a moment. This is Soundcheck. I'm Erin McKeown. We were just talking about the rituals of creative people. Now we're going to take a look at a band that has become known for very different kind of rituals. I'm talking about Black Sabbath. The band had the number one album in the country last week, and here with me in the studio, ready to talk about it, is music editor for Time Out New York, Steve Smith. Hello, Steve. Welcome to Soundcheck.
Hi, how are you?
Well, I have to say that today is the first time I will have ever heard Black Sabbath. I grew up in a pop culture hole, and anything before 1996 I didn't hear. And so first it was out of ignorance that I never heard Black Sabbath. Now it's out of will. Right? Because now at this point, I'm like, well, I've never heard them. But here we are today. This is my first time hearing Black Sabbath. Is there something I'm missing? What do you think about the fact I've never heard Black Sabbath?
Do you wear it as a badge of honor that you've not heard them yet? Or is it something where you really are sort of in public trying to correct a slight now?
I'm not trying to correct it.
Okay. Well, these things do happen. And the main thing is just to sort of come around to it. And I mean, you know, as ubiquitous as Black Sabbath is among a certain segment of the pop culture, I'm sure there are many people who have never encountered anything more than maybe a single riff in a Robert Downey Jr. movie. So, you know, I it's probably not that uncommon.
Well, maybe I have and I didn't know, or there's somewhere in the water or in the air I'll recognize some things we're going to talk about. But I certainly know that I have not heard the new album 13. But I'm told that it's their 19th studio album.
That's correct.
There's also 8 songs on it. What's going on here?
Well, you know, this is where I get into my sort of private cryptographer mode. Black Sabbath recorded 8 albums back in the 1970s with their so-called classic lineup, which was the singer Ozzy Osbourne, the guitarist Tony Iommi, the bassist Geezer Butler, and the drummer Bill Ward. And they put out 8 albums in really fast succession back when you knocked out 2 albums a year. And they sort of spiraled into a haze of drugs and animosity. And after 8 albums, Ozzy walked out the door. Black Sabbath continued onward for, you know, well into the 90s with a series of other singers. And some of them were more successful than others. Ronnie James Dio was the next singer after Ozzy Osbourne. And he's an iconic heavy metal guy. So the audience took to him. And they had some real success on the albums they made with Ronnie. My pet theory about the title 13 is that if you just take the 8 albums with Ozzy Osbourne, the 3 albums with Ronnie James Dio, and the 1 album with Ian Glover from Deep Purple, and you erase all the other ones that are sort of marginal, then this one would be number 13 if those others just never existed.
I wish I could do that with, like, relationships or...
Wouldn't it be great? you know, just sort of redact your past. But it was a shame that the 4 of them couldn't come back together. You know, originally when they announced this reunion and Henry Rollins presided over their press conference, and it was an exciting thing because they were all 4 there. But there were contractual, you know, animosities. And, you know, basically the drummer Bill Ward is not along for the ride. And, you know, I was skeptical. I think the album works remarkably well. I'll put my cards on the table. But I was skeptical going into it. And, you know, you're still not going to say that 13 is on a par with the early Black Sabbath records. But it's certainly, it's faithful to their spirit, and it's an honorable way to, I don't know, perhaps close a career.
One of us is headbanging in the studio listening to that.
Yeah, and I was moving around a little bit too, actually. No, I saw. It has that effect. I mean, even unconsciously, you were bobbing your head too. It's just, you know, this band is known for setting up, you know, grooves that sort of make you move spontaneously and really, really memorable riffs. Those are the two things, and I think that 13 delivers those really well.
We're talking with Steve Smith, music editor for Time Out New York, about the long-running heavy metal band Black Sabbath. I'm Erin McKeown, in for John Schaefer on Soundcheck. We heard a little bit of Ozzy Osbourne's vocals on that track. And of course, for someone who doesn't know Black Sabbath, I only know Ozzy Osbourne from his reality TV show days. I'm going to have a hard time taking him seriously as a singer here. Why should I?
You know, for the other members of Black Sabbath who were in and out of the band for years and years and years, this is kind of a return to form. But I would say for Ozzy, in a sense, this is kind of a return to dignity. You know, the first three or four albums of his solo career were really, really strong albums, and he was a chart-topping entity. And then somewhere along the line, he morphed into this kind of slightly fuzzy, muzzy sort of paterfamilias on reality TV. And, you know, suddenly we've gone from Ozzy and Harriet to Ozzy and Sharon. And, you know, Ozzy was never the most technically virtuosic singer, but what he had was heart and a believable kind of despair to his voice. I mean, early Black Sabbath, you know, it was a product of its time. It was coming out of Vietnam, and it was also coming out of, you know, impoverished industrial areas in England. And so this was kind of the white kid's blues for British music. And, you know, these guys especially, they came straight out of being a blues band, and you never, ever lose sight of that in the first handful of albums, and you hear it again really strongly in 13. One of the great things about 13 is that they've got that kind of blues-based alchemy again. You know, the album swings in its best points, and, you know, Tony plays like he plays solos like a blues master. And Ozzy, to his infinite credit, you know, rises to the challenge and gets that mood precisely.
Well, let's talk about a track from 13, Dear Father. And this track has some sound effects at the end of it that are, in fact, similar to sound effects that begin the 1970 debut album Black Sabbath, so that I wonder, I'm thinking like in your iTunes player, do you put them next to each other? Do they fade into each other? Is this some sort of like, here we are back at the beginning? Is this new life, or is this Black Sabbath is done?
Well, the question you're posing is actually the question that explicitly starts 13 as well. The very first thing that Ozzy sings on this album, and, you know, forgive the bad poetry, it's always been that way, but the very first thing he says is this the end of the beginning or the beginning of the end? Either way you look at it, I feel like something about 13 is meant to be closure and a return to where they all started. I don't want to get too deeply into psychological motivations. But very honestly, this is an album where the primary architect, Tony Iommi, has been facing a fight against lymphoma in public for the last year. And Ronnie James Dio, the singer in another version of Black Sabbath, which recently reunited under the name Heaven and Hell, you know, Ronnie James Dio just lost a battle to cancer very, very quickly. So mortality has to be on Tony's mind. And the notion of bringing this grand project of his back around full circle, I think, becomes explicit in the moment that you're talking about. Because at the very end, after Dear Father goes through its sort of bluesy, you know, paroxysms and whatever, at the end, you hear the rainstorm, and you hear a bell, and you hear thunder. It's basically a 21st century digital update of exactly the same sounds that started the very first Black Sabbath record. So I think it bookends a career, if that is indeed the case. I've heard rumors since that they're enjoying themselves so much they might go forward, but I think that they went into this wanting to make this statement.
Let's listen. Dear Father. That was Dear Father, Black Sabbath, from their new album, 13. I'm talking with Steve Smith, music editor for Time Out New York. I'm Erin McKeown, in for John Schaefer on Soundcheck. Steve, you are a self-professed Sabbathologist, if I said that right.
Sabbathologist, exactly.
All right, you're exactly. A Sabbathologist.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're going to do Sabbath for Dummies, me being the dummy who has not heard much Sabbath now, except for a few clips. We're going to pick some songs.
Sure.
Play it for me, and I'll react. What's the first song you want to do?
Well, let's start at the very beginning, because it's an awfully good place to start.
I'm dying to say this. We're about to listen to Black Sabbath by Black Sabbath from the record Black Sabbath. So that was it. That was Black Sabbath by Black Sabbath from Black Sabbath. I mean, honestly, listening to it, I guess I'm surprised by how much space is in the music. When I think of heavy metal, I think of like that never stops.
Sure. You're thinking of that riffing intensity that sort of came along with a slightly later band. Judas Priest and Iron Maiden sort of amplified the testosterone factor, and then when you took that out to, of all places, the Bay Area, and you gave it to Metallica and Slayer, all of a sudden it's aggression overdrive. And I'll say that I mean coming to this album again, I responded the same way that you are. It also seemed anomalous to have something that was so slow and so spacious. In it, over time, it has become extremely influential. I mean, you know, two major subsects of the metal religion, stoner metal and doom metal, you know, can be traced almost entirely back to this one record. So it was iconic, and it continues to resonate.
Let's go to our second clip now. This is Iron Man. My impression of that is of 1,000 young men in their basements practicing that drum entry. That's what I imagine. I've certainly, in all the guitar stores I've been in my lifetime, I have heard that riff before. This is one of those songs that is sort of in the pop culture air. It's been made fun of plenty of times.
It's a total Beavis and Butthead kind of a riff. And, you know, if you're going to own one Black Sabbath record, arguably Paranoid is the one, because you get Iron Man, which has that super memorable riff, and I am Iron Man. I mean, how bad would that Robert Downey Jr. movie have been if they hadn't licensed that tune? It just had to be there. And the title track, Paranoid, similarly, it's one that you've heard even though you don't know you've heard it. Practically every song on the album spawned one or two bands that took that song as their name. So, you know, that one is a high watermark for metal and for rock in general. And yes, audience, I saw Erin bobbing her head too.
It's kind of, honestly, it's kind of hard not to.
Exactly. That's the point.
That's the point. All right, you have one more song for me today. What is it?
The last song in the stack is Sweet Leaf, which you can imagine what's being referred to here because, you know, if you're talking about teenagers and heavy metal and you know, banging your head, there are certain chemical inducements that can make that process more enjoyable, more mellow. And so, you know, if you cue this song up, the first thing you hear is Ozzy clearing his throat and then, again, one of those Tony Iommi riffs that's been stolen by everybody from Anthrax to the Beastie Boys to the Butthole Surfers. Everybody has stolen this riff, and that's another crucial part of what Black Sabbath is all about. All right
now. My guest is Steve Smith, music editor at Time Out New York, who may have possibly gotten me interested in Black Sabbath. Thanks so much for being here, Steve.
Thank you.
Up next, husband and wife-led band The Handsome Family join us to play songs off their new animal-filled album called Wilderness. I'm Erin McKeown, in for John Schaefer, and you're listening to Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm Erin McKeown, in for John Schaefer. The Handsome Family, led by the husband and wife duo of Brett and Rennie Sparks, have been making their idiosyncratic Americana for more than 20 years. Over the course of 10 albums, they've sung murder ballads, myths, and tales of historical figures, like Amelia Earhart and Nikola Tesla. Above all, they're storytellers. Now, for their latest album, called Wilderness, the band has taken us on a journey into all things wild, with every song named after an animal. The Handsome Family is here in the studio. They're going to start things off with the song Octopus, live on Soundcheck.
One, two, one, two, three, four. The octopus has three hearts. It lives in caves below the sea, or in a beer can, or a bathtub, or in a puddle on the street. Any fisherman can tell you when an octopus waves its arms, it hypnotizes schools of fish. All movement stops for miles, and even the waves stand still. All the witnesses have sworn it's impossible to resist the urge to jump overboard. That's why I try and stay away from seashore holidays. But I know that no one has to know if I take an evening stroll down to the end of the wooden pier where the water's deep and cold. I should see an octopus lift its arms out of the sea, or see its shadow rising up above the rooftops and the street. I'd follow those dancing limbs to the spinning edge of the sky, where all the boats fall off the world into the octopus's eye. That's why I know I shouldn't go on a cruise across the sea. 'Cause I know that no one has to know when I take an evening stroll down to the end of the wooden pier where the water's deep and cold. That's why I try and stay away from seashore holidays. 'Cause I know that no one has to know if I take an evening stroll down to the end of the wooden pier where the water is deep and cold.
That's my guest, the Hanson Family, here on Soundcheck. Brett Sparks on the lead vocals and electric guitar, Rennie Sparks on the bass, Jason Toth on the drums. Welcome to Soundcheck.
Hi.
Hello.
There are so many things I didn't know about an octopus that I learned from that song. Is that the same for you?
Some of them are true, too.
Once I found out that the octopus has three hearts, I knew I had to tell people.
And what is not true? So the octopus has three hearts, and now I know from reading the accompanying book, which we're going to talk about, but I know from reading the accompanying book that the octopus also has its arms. What is it about its arms that are special?
It can think with its arms, so even if cut an arm off and it will regrow again, so it's okay to do this kind of game at home. You can cut the arm off and it will go search for food and try to pick up pieces of food and put it where its mouth was. So I don't really know how it must feel to be able to think with your arms. The only way to find out is by cutting your arm off, and I'm not ready for that step, but
crazy arms.
They're pretty amazing creatures.
Yeah, I've always thought octopuses are kind of creepy. Actually, because there's all the stories about them, like climbing out of their cage or their tanks and doing all kinds of stuff like that. With this song, you know, it's ostensibly about the octopus and facts about the octopus, but it ends up being as much about the singer and the observer of the octopus as the octopus itself. And your album, I think this is characteristic of a lot of the songs on the album, that you start out with this sort of, here's an observation from nature, but then it becomes, here's an observation about the narrator. How does that work for you?
Well, I think even when we're not aware of it, no one really is able to look at a willow tree and not kind of think, maybe it's weeping. It's just what human brains do. We place our emotions and our dreams on the outside world, so we're really not able to see anything objectively, so I don't even try anymore. I say, I want to see the octopus dance, and I will step off the edge of the world into its arms if it would allow me.
Rennie, you've mentioned composing lyrics by starting with notebooks full of scribbles. And I'm curious, like, as a visual artist, the way you guys work is like this. So, Rennie, you write the lyrics, and then you give them to Brett, who does the melody and the music and the production on the records. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, at the beginning, you have these observations about nature or yourself, and you start to write about them. What does it look like in the journal on the page the first time?
Well, my handwriting's pretty bad, so that's part of the problem.
Oh, no, it's lovely.
So,
A for penmanship.
I often don't even know what I've written sometimes when I go back to it. Is that an octopus or is that a jellyfish? So I just write down all the things that strike me when I'm reading about the natural world. And there's just so much that I'm often just struck dumb by finding out things like how the eels have these enormous journeys across the world. And then they finally get to where they're going and they turn around and come back. But it is one thing to know these things and another thing to be able to sing a song about what you know. I think when you're singing a song, it's a little different than writing an essay about facts. I think that's where the dreams come in, and that's where the human longings come in.
I'm dying to know, do you have a go-to place for animal facts?
Well, we live in the wilderness of the internet, so there's everything you want to know about everything is there just for the searching of it. And people put out incredible papers from the most scholarly works to, I also love reading things like there's wonderful papers written by creationists who cite all these different intricacies of the animal kingdom as proof of a intelligent design. And for like termite mounds, they say, well, that must prove there's a God behind everything. And to me, that says, well, a termite mound is something full of longing, just the way people are when we build bridges and skyscrapers, and I just can't believe that anything infinite could have any need to build anything.
I'm Erin McKeown, in for John Schaefer on Soundcheck. I'm talking with the Handsome family today, Brett and Rennie Sparks. This next song that you guys are going to play is called Woodpecker, but it's not necessarily about a woodpecker. Can you tell us more about the person that it's about?
Yes. Well, it is about woodpeckers, but it's also about Mary Sweeney, who in the 1890s, she was a real woman who was arrested hundreds of times in Wisconsin in little towns for attempting to smash windows with her bag. And she couldn't give really no explanation for her actions. And, you can just assume, well, she was a crazy lady or she didn't like to see her reflection. But I also, at the same time I was reading about her, read that woodpeckers are able, as they're flying overhead, to hear bugs crawling within tree trunks. Yet, at the same time, woodpeckers, when they bang their head against a trunk, they have no problem hammering away. So they can see some things, they can hear some things, they can't hear other things. And I think Mary Sweeney may have been cursed with seeing things in the glass that no one else could see. And that's what the song's about, really.
Well, if you're ready to play it, let's hear Woodpecker.
Was just a quiet schoolmarm, old Leopard from across Wisconsin. She took a pinch of cocaine, only for her nerves. Laudanum for trembling hands, a little bar.
That was Woodpecker by my guests, the Handsome Family, here on Soundcheck. Brett Sparks, lead vocals and electric guitar. Rennie Sparks, backing vocals and banjo. Jason Toth on the drums. Their new album is called Wilderness. It's out now. There's an accompanying book, Wilderness Essays and Art, by Rennie Sparks. And the Handsome Family is playing tomorrow, Saturday, June 29th, at the Knitting Factory. You know, artists do a lot of different things, and you guys have done a couple things, I think, that will allow you to keep doing this. One is you moved. You left mm-hmm. Chicago and you went to New Mexico and become more of a self-contained group. In that way, you write, you know, you record, you produce everything within your home. Mm-hmm. And then the second thing is you've also made a book. You've added a book to this experience of your music. The book, again, we said it was called Wilderness, and it's essays and art that relate song by song to this record.
Well, I've always been a writer hiding in a band, so I finally just let myself say all the things I wanted to say that are circling around all the songs. And I think if you like the songs, then you'd be interested to know what the thoughts were that were circling through my head when the lyrics were written.
I think also this is a time when you really have to do something special to kind of stand out. I mean, music is in a place now where, like, you're not really, people don't even consume music. It just kind of exists in the ether, and it's, you know, zeros and ones, and people listen to it on their phones and, you know, on their pads and
it's
on
easy
Spotify
to press
and this
next.
And that.
Or doing something else at the same time. So what if the other thing you're doing at the same time is looking at the book? That's how I experienced your record.
That's acceptable.
Is that good? I put the record on my headphones, and then I have the book on my iPad, sorry.
and looked at it
at the same time and had a really rich experience.
Well, that's nice. That's great.
Yeah, I think it's really easy to have no rich experiences during your day and night, the way we live in our world. So any path that we can take to ponder a little deeper, to explore some more mysterious pathways is always good.
This is Soundcheck. I'm Erin McKeown in for John Schaefer. I'm talking with the Handsome Family today. Their new album is called Wilderness. I should have asked you guys this way earlier in the interview, but why are you called the Handsome Family?
Oh.
Well, I like to think it lives somewhere between the Carter family and the Manson family.
Not that you aren't handsome, by the way.
Somebody just named us that and it stuck. And, you know, it's one of those names you could build with a couple of times and just kind of go with it.
Well, I want to thank you guys so much for being on Soundcheck today. Once again, this was the Handsome Family, Brett Sparks, Rennie Sparks with Jason Toth here on the drums. Their new album is called Wilderness, and you guys are playing tomorrow, Saturday, June 29th, in Brooklyn at the Knitting Factory. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
High in that crystal palace, I built a sailing ship, mast and wheel of polished brass. Tales of gold and silver.
That's going to do it for Soundcheck today. Next week, John Schaefer's back for a week-long special we're calling the Writers Club. We'll feature conversations with authors talking about music and musicians talking about books. Our authors include Juno Diaz, Jennifer Egan, Khaled Hosseini, and George Saunders. And we'll hear from musicians Patti Smith, Martha Redbone, and Ben Folds. It all kicks off on Monday with Scottish crime writer Ian Rankin. We're going to leave you with a little more from our guests, the Handsome Family. This is the song Owls.
The blue house at the corner of Twilight and State. Four stories, soaring turrets, floors of wood parquet. And owls, so many owls, snowy horn and screech. Thousands of owls, all flapping their wings. How I loved the marble staircase, the claw-footed tubs, the rooms of rare orchids, the glass hall for my guns, statues of pharaohs, 20 feet tall, crystal chandeliers, rare paintings of clowns. But the owls, so many owls, I'm never alone. The owls make this blue house a home. How peaceful it is to watch them soar through the palm tree ballroom with its gold paneled door.
The song Owls by the Handsome Family, recorded here in the Soundcheck studio. You can stream the full session on soundcheck.org. Soundcheck is a production of WNYC. Irene Trudell leads our engineering team with Paul Schneider, Bill O'Neill, and Jason Isaac. The show is produced by Greta Cohn and Katie Bishop with Alex Kappelman and our interns Alex Martinez and Ian Petrarca. Our digital producer is Mike Katziff and our executive producer is Joel Meyer. All right, that's it. This ends my stint as the Soundcheck guest host. Thank you so much for having me. If you want to find out more about me and my music, you can go to aaronmckeown.com. Just try to spell it and Google will get you there. Thanks. This is Soundcheck.